interviewing,
Godfrey Fowler,
Derek Hockaday, on the 7th of March. Godfrey, I think you would have come up to the Oxford Medical School, which in a sense is what we're talking about. You'd have come up in 49.
I came up in 50, actually. Right, yes. Yeah.
And what did you think of the admissions procedure?
Well, from what I remember, the admission procedure, I came up in late 49 to sit a SCOL exam, discovered that the uni had a medical scholarship, and I sat a scholarship exam in Balliol Hall in 1949 for six colleges who were doing it at the same time. And I remember a chap called Sandy Ogston, was a wonderful chap, was looking after us for the week. So we spent the whole week sitting, what about 10 three-hour papers or something. And I decided, staying in uni, that there was no way I was going to get into this great university. So we were told on the Friday night that those who were going to be interviewed would be put up, their names were put up on a list in Balliol Lodge. So on the way to the station on Saturday morning, I thought I'd better go and just check that bit, make sure my name isn't on it. And I remember a great feeling of disappointment, actually, that my name was on it, because I really decided I didn't want to come to Oxford. I was really put off by the fact that all the chaps around in the exam seemed to be cleverer than me, and they'd all been to posh schools, which I hadn't, and that sort of thing. But anyway, I did stay on until Saturday, and I remember being interviewed in UNIV by the master and the tutor there, Dan Cunningham, who was a very young-looking man to be a tutor. And much to my great surprise, I was offered a scholarship. So really, there was no two ways about it. Mm. So the entrance thing was very simple, yes, as far as I was concerned.
What had made you go try for Oxford in the first place?
Well, no one from my school had ever been to Oxford or Cambridge, and I'd done my school certificate and high school certificate, had a chemistry master who thought I was a clever chap, knew I wanted to do medicine, and he said, you know, aim high, go for Oxford or Cambridge. And the headmaster said, waste of time, nobody from this school has ever done that before.
This was in the Potteries, was it?
This was in Worcestershire, in Worcestershire. And that master insisted that I did it. So it was entirely down to him that I actually did that. And, you know, I think what a wonderful man he was to have seen that opportunity. So it was actually much simpler than one might have thought.
So when you came, you know, and settled in, did you regret it, or were you glad?
Well,
I felt
very uncomfortable. I can remember during the first year that I was at University College, because I did feel that I was a bit out of my depth in terms of social.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. Gosh. Well, I was. I came from a very, very simple, humble background. My, you know, had parents both of whom left school at 14, and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was actually a great shock to me to be in such a high-powered.
And did you feel in any sense you were bullied, socially bullied, not physically?
I can't say I did. I mean, I think everybody was very kind, I have to say that. And I got very interested in rock climbing for some reason, partly because I climbed a lot of trees as a boy, I suppose.
Yes.
And that really was my enthusiasm. Mm.
So did you climb the colleges?
Yes, I'm afraid so.
I can't remember the
camera certainly was what one thing, and I remember very well the getting round the overhang with the depending on getting hanging onto the lightning conductor. The only way you could do that. and someone in many years later was killed when the lightning conductor gave way and it came off. But yes, I'm afraid I did that.
Did you do that at night?
Yes, we did it at night. Yes. And it was one of the things that was done. You know, nobody thought it was awful.
No.
It was exciting.
Yeah, that's right.
I wouldn't do it today.
Isn't it? So then you did BM after 2 years.
Yes,
probably.
Right. Yeah.
And then went on for a year of school's work.
Yes, that's right.
And how did you enjoy the two different bits, as it were?
Yeah, I think it was very exciting to have the opportunity to do schools and to test oneself. I must say, my tutor wanted me to stay on and do a BSc and DPhil and all that. I didn't want to do that because I really wanted to get on and get qualified, and that was my ambition in life, and to get on and be a GP somewhere nice.
And did Dan farm you out to other tutors? Or?
Yes. one in particular who was a biochemist. What's his name? Pembroke.
O'Brien. Percy O'Brien.
That's right. Who was a very lively, very different from Dan. And actually, when I came back to Oxford as a GP, Percy came into my surgery one day and said, "I've never had a doctor in Oxford. I hate doctors. But I've discovered you come back as a GP, and I think I'd like to register with you since I taught you."
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
And he did.
Yeah. And do you remember people lecturing and so on? I mean, what do you remember in those years? Who were the good lecturers?
I didn't go to many lectures. Mm-hmm. We didn't go to many lecturers, mm-hmm. I think, in those years. I can't honestly remember. There was a biochemist, Percy O'Brien, I've already mentioned. Mm-hmm. There was a nice chap at Merton, Parsons, Dennis Parsons,
yes,
who was a very persuasive lecturer. I think there was a chap at York College as well.
George Gordon.
George Gordon, that's right, who was, very good.
Yes, good. Mm-hmm. And Krebs, what did people think of Krebs?
I didn't come across Krebs at that time, but I did later.
Yeah. In what respect, as a patient?
Well, through Percy. Percy O'Brien,
yes,
who said, it's down to me that Krebs had a place in Oxford because nobody else was interested in it. I didn't know that.
No. And O'Brien really thinks he was the guy who persuaded Krebs to come.
Well,
or persuaded
Oxford. Also provided him with some accommodation initially, apparently, in his lab.
Good.
He always claimed that.
Right. That is fascinating, actually. I mean, was that in the 30s or in the 50s?
In the 50s.
Yes, no, I understand. Mm-hmm. Great. And then why did you decide to go down to London for your clinical?
Well, there was really no choice in those days, from what I can remember. I think there were 72 in my year, and I seem to remember there were 6 people who stayed on in Oxford. But they were all people who were married, had families, or had reasons like that. So it never discussed with me whether I should stay on in Oxford. It was assumed. And I was really literally told by Dan that since I wasn't a rugby player, the best thing to do was to go to a place like UCH.
No, in those days one did what one was told, so really you were directed to UCH by Dan.
Yeah, more or less. But I mean, I didn't know anything about it, so I was happy for him to do that. And he said, it was one of the more serious clinical schools, UCH. Some of the others were into sport and all that
stuff. Yes. Then what led you eventually to come back to Oxford? Because I know there's a very interesting time in between, but we're meant to talk about Oxford.
Well, that was really rather freakish in that I think I was destined to go on to do paediatrics because I did just initial job at UCH and I did the DCH and membership, and then I did a job to Great Ormond Street for a short time with the two paediatricians from UCH. And I wasn't sure I wanted to be in paediatrics. And one of the things that when I briefly became a registrar back at UCH as a locum, one of the things I hated was having to see the parents of children who had died on the ward.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days it was quite common because congenital heart disease was untreatable, leukemia was untreatable, mm-hmm. Of childhood cancers a lot of children died on wards in paediatric teaching hospital. And I thought, gosh, I don't want to spend my life interviewing parents who've lost children because I find it a very painful thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd always had the ambition to be a GP, because that was really, I think, based on the village doctor at where I lived, that I liked him and his job and so on. As a student, I'd gone down to spend a week with the GP in Wiltshire, in Chippenham, and he was a UCL chap who was willing to have occasional students, and that wasn't common in those days, and I liked that idea. But it was really the dean at UCH who knew I was uncertain about what I wanted to do, and I'd done a job for him at UCH, a house job, said, well, there's a very good practice in Oxford looking for a new GP. I think I know him because the chap was at UCH years ago and he's a very highly regarded person. Why don't you go and see him and see whether they are interested? So I came up to Oxford to see this chap, and I was very taken by him, and he said, yes, well, why don't you come for a year, and we're happy to take you for a year as a trainee, and if you like it, you can stay on, and we'll, if we like you, we'll keep you on, and if you don't, you can go back to what you were doing. And I spent a year in Oxford with him, and I was convinced that that was really what I wanted to do, particularly as I then had become quite a reasonable young paediatrician, and I felt confident about dealing with children, and I could see that that was very important in paediatrics, in general practice. Mm. So that's how it happened, really.
And was Raymond Green the other partner?
No, he wasn't. He wasn't then. He had been in the past.
Yes.
Raymond Green had gone back to London to be a hospital consultant some years before. And I think his particular interest in was thyroid disease.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And when you joined it, was it still in the Broad, or had you moved to Birmingham?
No. It was then from Alan Richards. He was the senior partner. There was another partner. Was not a very prominent partner, but he was a nice enough chap. But he didn't compare with Alan as a quality as a GP. He practiced from his house in Banbury Road. And that's where I worked from for the first few years as well.
So when did students begin to appear in the
well,
practice?
I of course, students didn't really see anything of general practice in those early days as I remember, but I used to have occasional students come into my practice because medical students would say to the director of clinical studies, you know, can't we see something of general practice?
Mm-hmm.
And I was identified as a young GP who was willing to have students in his practice. So I used to have students come into the practice from time to time, and I greatly enjoyed that. And I think they enjoyed it too. And I learned quite a lot of things from students. I remember one of the things I used to say, particularly in my early years in general practice, to patients who I really didn't know what was wrong with them, I would sort of take the histories and examine them and say, and so on, well, I don't know what it is. What do you think it is?
Mm-hmm.
And students told me they'd never heard somebody in the hospital say that to them. And I must say, I found that a very useful
It's thing. A very good question. Witz always used to say, what do you want me to do for you? Which is another very
is
good
that
question.
Right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
When he was really puzzled, didn't he?
Yes, yes.
But
I was very keen that students should learn more about general practice, so I think I was part of a sort of small pressure group that was trying to encourage the medical school to do something about giving clinical students some sort of contact with general practice.
And Andrew would be doing this at TAME? Or
yes,
not?
Andrew Marcus, who was a very close friend of mine, because we've been at UNIF together, we've been at UCH together, and I like to think that Andrew gave up his ideas of being a hospital doctor to become a GP because I'd come back to Oxford and had survived for a year or two, and he thought, well, it can't be so bad if God rich.
So you went into general practice before Andy?
Yes, I did.
Right.
I came into general practice in 1959.
Right.
And it wasn't a popular choice with students in those days. So, and Andrew, I think, had been watching me and thought, yeah, he gets on.
Yes. And had you done national service?
No, I didn't do national service. And that was one of the differences.
Yes, no, I understand. And the group, you say, can you name any of the others who were keen on this?
On?
The GPs who were trying to get the school to do something. Ball?
Yeah, Mike Ball was interested. He was not particularly interested in having students in his practice, I seem to remember, but he found that he was very protective of his patients. I probably was less protective of my patients. And I think another factor that influenced me was that I'd started to have, started to become a college doctor in Oxford.
Right.
So, and I was, had, you know, more non-medical students, yes, in my practice, so I was used to that.
So when did you begin that, and how many colleges?
I did began that in very early on, and that again was another freakish thing, because it happened that Lord Florey became the Provost of Queen's, I think it was in 1961, and I was really very, very much a young doctor, GP myself then. Florey was a patient of Anna Richards. I mean, Anna Richards had a lot of interesting, significant people like C.S. Lewis and all these, and that was one of the great things about,
yes,
general practice, and particularly in those days. Anyway, I found myself looking after Florey because Alan Richards had gone off on holiday for a month, and I found myself looking after Florey when he was really quite ill, because he had a lot of trouble with coronary heart disease,
mm-hmm,
really at a relatively young age. I think he was in his late 50s, early 60s. And so I got on with him really quite well, and when he became Provost of Queen's, which I think was in about 1961, he discovered that Queen's had a very old GP as its college doctor,
mm-hmm,
who was at least in his 70s and might even have been in his 80s. And Florey decided this was outrageous, and that he really have to. So he said to the college, I've got a very good young GP, I think he'd make an excellent college doctor. Of course, you can imagine what the, some of the other fellows of Queen said about that. But Florey was a very determined man.
Yes.
Quite clear, he was a very determined man. So I was opposed by many of the older fellows at Queen's. I was opposed, I may say, by the other doctors who were college doctors in Oxford, who felt I was much too young and inexperienced to become a college doctor. And there was a major confrontation, which even involved the British Medical Association, because the College Doctors Association appealed to the British Medical Association that this was really outrageous, that Florey should be pushing his... of course, the BMA didn't want to know about it.
No.
And Florey won.
Penicillin
Florey. So I became a college doctor at Queen's in 1960. I was very young. I mean,
yes,
I was only 30,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
Most of the college doctors were in their 40s and 50s. Mm. So it was an interesting time.
Yeah. And when did you get another college?
Oh, I gradually accumulated about half a dozen colleges over the next 10 or 15 years, I suppose. And in the 60s, I felt college student healthcare was badly managed in Oxford, because most, I'm ashamed to say, most of the college doctors were more interested in having dining rights in colleges than they were in looking after students. I campaigned along with a gang of students who were pressing the university to establish university health service for students. And I had quite a bit of encouragement from various people, including a chap called Bent Yule Jensen,
oh, yes,
who was the university,
yes,
medical officer.
Yeah.
And I travelled around to other medical schools, other universities, and discovered university healthcare systems, which I thought were very good. And I thought Oxford could benefit greatly from having a bit more professionalism, so to speak. Bent supported that. I wrote some sort of report which was dismissed by most people because I'd been to Manchester and to Sussex and places like this, and they were all snooty about that. Go to Cambridge, they said, but I knew very well that Cambridge. And Bent Yule Jensen said, what you need to do is to go to somewhere like Harvard and Yale and look at their university healthcare systems, which I know are very good because he'd been there. And I got a scholarship from, I think it was the World Health Organization or something, to go and spend 3 months at Harvard and Yale looking at their university health systems. And I came back, wrote a report, which went to some university committee, and Alan Bullock was the vice chancellor at the time. And he got very enthusiastic about it, asked me to go and see him and tell him about it, which I did, and said, right, we must have something like this in this university. He set up a committee, the Great and the Good, which collected evidence over several years and came forward with the recommendation that there should be some sort of university health care system in Oxford. Of course, it didn't didn't happen because all the colleges resisted it and said healthcare's got nothing to do with the university, it's a college matter, and we'll decide what we're going to do about it, which was, I think, typical of Oxford.
Yes, absolutely.
So I wasn't too surprised. Mm. But there was one area where they were couldn't be quite so dismissive, and that was in mental health. They were worried because there were student suicides and so on. So I'm glad to say there was one small outcome of all of that which I was proud of, which was that the university established a counselling service.
Mm-hmm.
And it still exists.
Mm-hmm.
So that's now 50 years ago.
Yes.
There still is a university counselling service paid for by the university. It's in Little Camden Street.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't entirely fruitless.
And did you go into the colleges and health surgeries, or did they come to
no,
you?
No, because we were in a vague, centrally located in Oxford, I didn't ever do surgeries in colleges, but we had. Later on we had nurses in colleges who had little surgeries and so on, college nurses, and that was a very good move to have college nurses.
Did you introduce them? Or?
I was certainly encouraged.
Yes.
It and colleges, I think colleges were getting round to it, and colleges were beginning to be feeling they ought to be more responsible.
Yes.
for healthcare.
And when did your group persuade the medical school to have an organised attachment to general practice for the students?
For medical students?
Yeah.
Oh, no, that really wasn't my initiative. That was Richard Doll who was responsible for that when he became Regis. It was clear that when Richard Doll became Regis and I met him together with some others, there were two things that Richard Doll was determined to do during his time as Regis. One was to establish a chair of public health.
Yes.
In Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
Which didn't exist at that time. There was someone called Alice Stewart.
Yes.
Who wasn't... She was in Keble Road and she was doing some interesting work, but she'd... And she'd been...
What was she nominally? Was she public
health?
Well,
she was a reader in public health. But
right.
She'd been the successor to a man whose name I've currently forgotten, who moved from Cambridge in the late 1940s. From being professor of medicine in Cambridge to become a Nuffield professor of public health, I think it was, in Oxford.
Was he Ryle?
Ryle.
Mm-hmm.
Ryle, that's
yes.
Right, Ryle,
yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
And that was an experiment, so to speak. He I think was in the first 5 years, and then the money ran out and the university medical school decided they weren't going to renew it. and so Richard Doll was determined to get that back,
mm-hmm.
in effect. And he did establish the chair of public health quite soon after he was became Regis. And Martin Vesey, who'd worked with
mm-hmm.
Doll at UCH, I must say, and I remember that from those days, became the professor. The other thing he was determined to do was to try and get something done about general practice, because there was
mm-hmm.
pressure from the General Medical Council. And many medical schools have got some sort of general practice appointment. And he was determined that this would happen in Oxford. And Richard Doll got one or two of us, me and Irvin Loudon.
Mm-hmm.
From Wantage.
Mm-hmm.
Together and said, can't you help me develop mm-hmm. the case?
And was Andrew there then? Or
no, Andrew was in the background. He
right.
didn't get involved in that, but he was very supportive
yeah.
of it. I'm trying to think who was particular. And the other thing was that John Hasler, there was a chap called
yes,
John Hasler,
was indeed.
And John had been responsible for development of postgraduate general practice education of GP, young
right.
GPs.
Yes.
And I had been involved in that as well, so
right.
I knew him very well. And Richard Doll knew that I was involved in that as well.
So Hasler was in practice somewhere,
was he?
He
was in Tonning Common. Yes,
right.
He was out.
I knew he was quite aware.
He was out with it quite aware. So
yeah.
he wasn't himself interested
right.
in this. But I was strongly supportive of this, and of course Irvin Loudon was strongly supportive of it. And Irvin had actually been on the clinical medicine board as a GP because
right.
he was a very able
yeah.
man
yeah.
and was highly highly respected and so on. So we put together some sort of case to go to the clinical medicine board in the 1970s to argue the case for a general practice post of some sort. And I was given the terrifying task of presenting this case to a meeting of the Clinical Medicine Board.
Yeah.
I have to say.
Was Dole in the chair?
Yes, he was in the chair, yeah. But he took back seat, yeah. So to speak. And it was a painful experience. and I remember someone, I think it better remain nameless, when I stood up to make my speech, said, the chap who was, said, "Come on, Godfrey, we all know you're a good GP, but don't try to persuade us there's anything academic about general practice." So there was caution about that whole thing, but it nevertheless was decided, apparently, at the Clinical Medicine Board that there should be some general practice posts, and they would probably have a readership at some point, but they couldn't find the money. Money was very tight in medicine at that time, so they couldn't justify spending money on a part-time readership in general practice. So they would put it on ice for 5 years. And Rosemary Rue, who of course was a huge supporter of all sorts of things in Oxford, is said to have said at the Medicine Board, "Look, I think this is so important that I'm willing to fund this post for 5 years so we can get it underway and get it started." And so that was agreed.
Right.
And so the powers that be sat together and eventually got around to advertising a half-time post readership in general practice, and I was sort of supportive of that, and I said, well, you know, if this guy needs to have a bit of GP job in Oxford, which he needs to have, because anybody who's teaching general practice has to be a GP of some sort, then they can come into our practice, and I've got the practice to agree to that. So the post was advertised, and I was aware that quite a lot of people had from around the place had expressed interest, though they didn't think it was very satisfactory to try and get somebody to come from outside and start all this up and so on. But things went ahead, and I was told that, I don't know, 15 or 16 people applied for the post. And about the day before the closure, I had a phone call from Richard Dole saying, "Godfrey, where's your application for this job?"
Right.
And I said, "Look, Richard, I don't want to do this job. I've been a GP in this practice for nearly 20 years now. I've just become a senior partner. I'm far too busy to do something else." And he said, "We want to see your application, because you may not feel you are academically qualified for the post, but we think the most important thing about this post is that it should have the support of local GPs, and we know you have credibility with local GPs and so on." So, gosh, I did apply for the post,
yes,
but assuming I wouldn't get it, thank God, and I would have, of course, I was appointed.
Mm.
And I remember John Ledingham was, I think, chair of the appointments committee.
Right.
I certainly remember the interview, all the talk was not about my qualities as an academic or my research skills or anything like that. It was all about support from local GPs. So I thought, well, on that basis, I better take it, you know.
Yeah.
And my wife was very opposed to me doing it, because she felt I was already busy enough and didn't want me to take on a whole new challenge. And it was a big challenge. I had to. We had to have changes in practice.
Yes,
I
was thinking. How part time was it? I mean,
it was half time to start
right,
with.
Yes,
but of course, it was more than half time.
Yeah,
than that.
Sure. Yes.
So I worked very hard.
Now we'll come back to what you did in the post. But the post is one thing, and clinical students being sent out to practices routine is another. When did that happen?
Well, that's strangely enough, that started just before I started this job, because before I'd even applied for the job, John Ledingham rang me up one day and said, look, we've discovered that clinical students have got to do an extra 2 weeks in the course to qualify to get a full time. They have to do 44 weeks or something.
So that was the GMC, was it?
The GMC, right. I think it was. God, what am I going to do with them? So I said, John, I'm sure we can find GPs around the county willing to have a student for a couple of weeks. And so John Nettingham said, what a good idea. Now, I said, what's it going to cost us? I said, well, I don't think it'll cost you very much because nobody will have to be paid for doing this. I think we'll find what it was, 70 GPs we needed, or 70 practices around the place. So I worked hard to recruit a lot of practices around Oxfordshire. All of them were delighted to have a student going, staying with them.
Yes, so the doctors actually put the students up on the hotel
side.
Yes,
it was amazing, really.
Yes.
And that was the start of it. And John said, well, that'll do for this year, but by next year we'll have sorted out something. But it was so popular with the students.
So John was director of clinical studies.
Yes, he was director of clinical. Yeah, that was enormously helpful that he was so supportive, and it was helpful that we'd known each other from the undergraduate days.
And his father had been a general
practitioner. And his father had been absolutely. So he was an enormous influence, I think, on the medical school, on other people who were a bit more sceptical about it.
Now, when you got in the readership post,
yes,
did you really just work on this sort of thing, or were you doing a research project?
Well, first of all, I had to work very much on the teaching thing, but then it became quite clear after a year or two that we had to have some sort of research credibility. And that was enormously enhanced by the job being within the Martin Vess's department. As we had an epidemiology department, which had a strong research thing.
So it was within that department?
I was within that. It was appointed within that department. And that really helped us to get things going. And I didn't have much in the way of research interests there. But one thing I had been interested in for quite a long time was tobacco. And because I'd just seen as a GP, the people I'd seen 15, 20 years before smoking chimneys, and now they were coming along with their chest infections and all the rest of it. So I thought, look, we've got to focus on this. So I really started doing work. The first serious research we did was a randomised controlled trial of GP advice in helping patients to stop smoking. And this was done by a DPhil student, an Australian DPhil student, sadly now dead, called Conrad Yamirshik, who became a very good epidemiologist. He did a very nice trial, showing a randomised trial control group, showing the effect of minimal advice from GPs in consultations on helping people to stop smoking, and found that we did have a significant small effect on the number of people who stopped smoking.
So you were already persuaded of Dole's work? I mean,
absolutely. I thought it was terrible that we all taking on board Dole's work, and the College of Physicians was producing reports on it. Nobody was doing any work on seeing whether there was anything we could do. So I started on that. I got eventually into the nicotine replacement trial thing, so we did some of that as well. So that was very much a focus, and I was enormously helped there with Walter Bodmer, who happened to meet at a meeting one day, and he heard me talking about this, and he said, Godfrey, is there anything we can do to help you? Your embryo department start up.
That's nice.
So I said, yeah, we need a bit of money so we can employ somebody to do research. And he did that. And we were funded by ICRF, the research group was, for several years.
So where was Bodmer getting the money, really, or persuading them to give it to
him? Well, he was ICRF's boss. And he Walter just... as far as I could see, he just said, I want to do this. And he seemed to have a great power and influence. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that he was the sort of chap that if you had him on your side, it could be an enormous benefit. If he didn't like you very much, and I may say I have had an experience of that when I retired, he took the money away from the department because he didn't like the person who took over for
me. Well. Now, to go back to one or two personalities, Bent was a remarkable man. What are your memories of Bent?
Well, Bent Julian.
Yeah.
He was... I liked him. I got on with him quite well, but not everybody did, as you will know. And it was helped by the fact that he was Danish and my wife was Norwegian. Mm-hmm. So we had a Nordic link, and I found that's quite helpful over the years.
Yes.
But it was certainly very encouraging
yes.
to me, and I never really had any serious conflicts with them, but it could be different.
Now, he was running the health service for the nurses and the medical students, is that right?
Yes,
and you weren't doing that?
No, we weren't. No.
And had the university got a medical service by that time? Or
no, the university never developed
doctors,
a medical,
yes.
medical service.
Yes.
I think it improved the college doctor system, and anyway, it just became something the university couldn't afford to fund in due course, I think. But in the 60s, particularly 60s and perhaps 70s, you know, there's no doubt about it that that students in the university had a second-class health service because GPs were interested in their patients who they knew over a period of time. Students were people who came and went, and they didn't get very much time. And they, you know, they really did get from some of the old GPs, you know, if you had any problems, all you need to do is play more rugger.
Then Dole had his moments with Alice Stewart, I think.
Sorry?
Dole had his moments with Alice Stewart.
Yes.
Because they were daggers drawn
I'm
at one
sure.
time.
They were very different personalities.
Right.
Yes.
But was that? Because Dole didn't believe her work on radiation
to
the spine.
No, he didn't. No, that's right.
And was he right, or...?
I don't know.
I don't know.
I didn't know enough about her work to be able to make any judgment about that. I think thought she was. Did you ever meet her?
Oh yes.
Yes. So she wasn't everybody's cup of tea, you know, I think there was that appointment of professor of public health was difficult for her too.
Yes.
Of somebody else taking on that job
yes.
was difficult for her.
Yes.
And she moved off to Birmingham.
Yes. Now, then you became the reader. I mean, sort of the professor.
Well, only at the very end.
Right.
Only at the very end. I was given a... It was decided in the late 80s, I suppose, early 90s, that they really had to establish a proper department of general practice with a chair and all the rest. And I may say David Wetherill was... strongly supportive of that then, but the problem was, as always, where to find the money for this. So I was given an ad hominem chair for the last year or two, which was very nice. And the status of general practice in the medical school seemed to be very high at the moment, and I'm very glad to see that, for example, the Director of Clinical Studies for the last 10 or 15 years has been a GP,
yes.
Tim Lancaster.
Yes.
The present Department of General Practice, or Primary Healthcare Sciences as it's now called, is blooming.
Mm-hmm.
It's got 250 people employed in it, a large research program, accommodation, the new Radcliffe
Did you get into work on contraceptives? Because that was very much in the department.
Not really. It was very much a Martin Bess's thing, and so I was very aware of it. And I must say, we worked well together, and of course the epidemiological skills in that department were actually invaluable to us in setting up research programmes.
And how much did you see of Dole in that department? Did he used to come in?
Yes, he was working next door in Richard Peters, with Richard Peters' group, of course.
Right. Mostly on tobacco smoking.
Oh yes, mostly on tobacco. Well, he went on doing that.
Yes. So, Jim Mann, Andrew Neil, did you come across
them? Yeah, of course. Both of them, and Jim I actually spoke to on the phone only a few days ago, because we had a telephone conversation. He'd published something in the BMJ, I think, which I did.
About sugar.
Yes.
Right. Yes, great. No, I know he did that last year.
I liked Jim very much, and I was very sad when he moved.
Why did he move?
Well, you tell me, Derek. I felt that Jim somehow had never been properly acknowledged in Oxford. Mm-hmm. I thought he was a clever man, he did very interesting work, and sadly he never really got full credit for that. He seemed to be more more acknowledged in the rest of the world than he did in Oxford. Yes. But that's not unique to him.
No, and it's certainly been the case since, hasn't it? You know, he's been...
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. No, it was... he was a very good friend, and he helped me a lot, I must say. And Andrew, of course, is his successor. We had a lot to do with each other. In fact, I think Andrew spent... always regarded himself as part of the Department of General Practice, the general practice side of the department, than on the public health side.
Yes.
Because we had, of course, we had clinical common ground.
Because he did diabetes studies in North Oxford.
Yes, indeed.
And were you involved in
that?
Yes.
Yes, we were involved with that, and we did books together.
Right,
Andrew and I, so that was very nice.
So, how many books have you written? Medical ones.
Well, one of the early things that happened when I got the readership was I was approached by OUP, by Alison Langton at OUP, who said, "We've got the Oxford Textbook of Medicine now. We've got the Oxford Textbook of Surgery. We're now looking for the Oxford Textbook of General Practice." So I said to Alison, "Alison, you must be joking." We're a long way from that. But if you really want us to produce something on general practice, aspects of general practice, I'm happy to help to edit a series of books on general practice. And I'm sure I can find people to write books and so on. So we did actually start in about 1980-81 producing something called the Oxford General Practice Series. And that went on for about 20 years, I think. We published over 40 books in the Oxford General Practice Series. I've got some of them on my shelf somewhere, on various aspects of general practice, which were quite popular in general practice. GPs don't buy a lot of books. But they did need to buy some for GPs, young GPs having GP training.
Yeah, yeah.
So we did that. So a lot of GPs contributed to them.
Did you write anyone yourself?
Yes, I was particularly interested in aspects of preventive medicine. So I did two or three on that, either on my own or with Muir Gray. I remember Muir. I did a very early book with Muir Gray, who was a great enthusiast, of course. And with Andrew Neil.
What was the one with Andrew about?
Well, it was on preventive medicine in general practice, I think. We did
So how many successors have you had since? People in the chair?
Yeah, okay. Well, I retired, I think it was in 96 that I retired. And the Oxford did its usual thing. It didn't appoint someone for a year. That's quite true. That's not quite true, because there was a chap called Martin Lawrence. Do you remember Martin Lawrence?
Yes, I do.
GP,
yes.
Chip and Norton.
Yes.
Very good GP.
Yes.
And clever chap, who'd been a lecturer in my department, who ran the department for a year after my retirement. So Oxford did its usual thing of not being able to find anybody who was good enough for the post. and eventually David Mount was given the job. He'd worked with me in the 80s in the department. He'd he'd been the deputy director of my research group. He was basically an epidemiologist. I mean, he had epidemiology training.
Mm-hmm.
And he ran the department for about 10 years. And then he retired, early retired, when he was 60, I think, only 3 or 4 years ago now. So having said it was a department had flourished, but he didn't want to carry on doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And the latest chap is a chap called Richard Hobbs, who's now the Professor of Primary Healthcare Sciences, because they've changed the title. I don't like that title, I have to say.
Yeah.
But everything has to be sciences these days. And he came from Birmingham, where he'd been the Professor of General Practice for about 20 years. I actually was involved in his appointment way back in whatever it was, the 80s, 90s. And he's very good, very dynamic, a powerful guy, and he seems to really producing dramatic changes in this department.
Good.
Large numbers of people, lots of money, and as I say, the university just, I saw something the Vice Chancellor had written the other day about his department, saying this was now going to be the centre of the whole Oxford and Mitchell.
But Mount had been to Canada, is that right?
No, I don't think.
So where did Mount go between Oxford and then?
He moved off to Southampton. He became a professor of primary healthcare epidemiology. David and I had a certain amount of conflict when we were in the department together, and eventually he resolved that by moving off. But he came back, and I think he did a very good job for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say, I'm delighted the department is such a powerful place these days.
As a GP in Oxford, and with your memories of UCL.
Yes, and of course, I carried on all this time, I might say, being a GP
practice,
and I really struggled to do that as I got more and more busy, but I enjoyed it.
Yes.
I stopped delivering babies in the middle of the night and things like that.
Yes.
But if I look back at my time, the part of my time that I enjoyed most was being a GP.
Yes.
And I think being a GP in the 60s and 70s was a very satisfying life. You felt you were doing something worthwhile. You were very involved with families. The relationships were very close. Lots of home visits and things like that.
Yes.
And I'm sad to see what general practice has become, which is a 9-to-5 job, no out of hours work. And I understand it.
Yes.
But it. You know, I hear, as I'm sure we all do, people saying, well, you know, it takes them 10 days to get an appointment. And
you ought to live near Wantage. But anyhow, that's another story. And as a GP, you know, there you are, and you remember the UCH. What did you think of the Oxford hospitals?
I don't really know the Oxford hospitals, though they exist now. I must
say, in those days, when you were...
I loved it in the early days, because it was the relationships were so close. You know, all the GPs knew all the hospital consultants, and I think most of the consultants used most of the GPs. We, of course, used to go in and see our patients in hospital quite commonly in those days. Life is somehow, I suppose, less busy, and certainly less paperwork to do. You know, if you wanted to refer somebody to a consultant, you wrote a letter at the end of the consultation surgery and sent it off to the doctor you knew, and you know, the communication was so much simpler.
I know things are always changing, but did you think Oxford was as good as UCH?
I was very fond of Oxford. In the end, when I first arrived at Oxford, I felt almost alienated as a student, but I got very fond of Oxford, of course. It's interesting that I actually, although I felt alienated when I first came here, when I had the opportunity to come back to Oxford as a GP, I felt somehow at home.
Yes.
And the way I think people do when they come back to Oxford. Mm. I remember being disappointed when I first came back after having been away for 4 or 5 years, about not bumping into everybody in High Street. I knew them all. I didn't know them all anymore. But I think Oxford was then. I think the size of the place was enormously helpful at all. London, I was never fond of London.
Yes, yes. What haven't I asked you that I should have?
I think we've covered.
Right.
Tell
me about perhaps national committees. Were you going up to?
Oh yes, I got involved in a lot of that, because it was extremely difficult to get GPs to go on national committees because the practices wouldn't release them to do that and say, well, who's going to see the patients while you're off doing this? So one of the advantages of being having some academic time. If I wanted to, I could go and spend some of that time on committees. And I was For example, I understand I was the longest serving member of the British Heart Foundation Council, which I joined in about early 1980s, which I finally got off about 20 years later. Mm-hmm. And that was not because they wanted me particularly, but they found it impossible to find anybody to replace me. No GP was willing to spend whatever it was, 4 or 5 days a year up at the British Heart Foundation sitting on their committee, because he didn't have the time to do that. So I became on a lot of the stroke association, the same thing happened. Mm-hmm. So I collected a lot of that sort of thing.
MRC or not?
No, never on the MRC, yes. Never on the MRC. And I think there is now almost certainly some GP on that.
And Royal College of Practitioners.
Oh yes, I was involved with them really right from the beginning.
Yeah, well, tell me about the founding of that.
Well, I wasn't not quite at the beginning. Yeah. I mean, it was founded in the early 1950s by an enthusiastic group of London doctors. The one I knew best was John Horder. You probably knew John Horder as well. So they were very, and it was undoubtedly was a good organisation, and of course it eventually got heavily involved in the postgraduate training of young doctors and developed training programmes and exams and all that sort of thing. So I had a lot of involvement in that in the 1970s and perhaps 80s particularly, and now it's got the biggest membership of any Royal College, I understand, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And there's makes a lot of money and does some good. But I think it's probably become a bit detached from real general practice.
So thinking of Martin Lawrence, because I can remember, bright young medical students, he and Theo Schofield, going into general practice for everybody, constantly.
Was that right?
Yes.
Yeah, because you knew them, of course, from the Oxford days.
Yes.
Yes.
They were young clinical students.
Yes. Well, I'm glad to say that though in the early days I had very great difficulty in getting help in the building up of the department, and I did get some money from, I think it was something called the Health Education Council, initially, to fund two GPs 2 days a week to come into the department, and Martin Lawrence and Theo Schofield are the two GPs that I persuaded to do that. So I was enormously lucky in that regard. I couldn't have done what I did in the 80s if I hadn't had good GPs willing to give up time.
But I mean, obviously they were influenced by you and others,
Oh yes, I was very much influenced by them. Right. I only heard about Theo the other day. I was asking the psychiatrist who talked to us about suicide.
Keith Orton.
He was very friendly with Theo, and he said Theo's now living on the south coast and in retirement.
I did, actually, because he comes up to the Oxford Medical Alumni Committees. Yes, he's very good, too.
Oh, yes. Theo's a great guy. And, of course, he is very good on the communication skills side of things. I mean, he became an expert on teaching students about communication skills.
Right. And
Martin Lawrence was a very clever chap. I mean, he'd read maths at Cambridge and got a first in maths at Cambridge and switched to it. He was a very clever guy.
And did he have a lot of influence all the time? I mean, medical students would have gone out to Chippy Norton.
Yes, he did.
And now, in the present, are they still being put up by the GPs?
I don't know. I don't think so.
No, they drive their cars out there.
I don't think so. I think that probably is old hat now. But it was, in the early days, it was very exciting for students to do that. They really did enjoy it.
And how much lecturing to the clinical students from your department happened?
Well, not a lot, but what we did, most of our teaching was done in small groups. We did a lot of small group teaching, and that I think they liked. What they liked most of all, of course, was being out in practices and seeing another side of medicine.
Yes. I always remember there was a chap contemporary with me who went into general practice in Wales, South Wales, and after a few weeks or so I met him, and he was miserable, didn't like it.
No.
Saw him a year later, and he's happy as Larry, and he said, I've realised I'm looking after the flock. In a sense, I'm not looking after the individual sheep, I'm looking after the flock.
Yes, yes,
and of course, it's such an interesting contrast, as there always is,
yes,
between the public health of a community,
absolutely,
and the health of the bedside individual.
Yes, yes. Yes, I never had, I mean, I'm aware of that having been a very important thing for many GPs. Now, sure, for example, the practice in Wantage, which always had the reputation of being, you know, a very good practice, which it was, it had
it
its
flock.
In Oxford, it's not the same, because the way the population is built up.
Do you feel it was right, or, I mean, was it sad that you didn't get a really big health centre on the Green College side, you know, the back of it, Walton Street?
I'm now a patient in my old practice, and I go there from time to time. As it happens, I was there one day earlier this week where we were talking about that very, very problem. When I first came to Oxford as this sort of trainee in 1959, there was a medical officer of health called John Wareham.
Yes, indeed.
Who was very enthusiastic about health centres.
Very good man.
Very good man.
Yes.
And with George Bodmer, who he knew quite well, and who was then the chief medical officer.
Oh, yes.
They decided they'd start to develop health centres in Oxford.
Godber.
Yes. And I was put, because I was the only trainee GP in Oxford, I was put on this committee by John Wareham to be a young trainee GP and helped us with the health centre thing. And he said, I remember John Wareham saying, of course, your practice in Oxford, after all, Bamby Road, house in Bamby Road is not an ideal place to practice medicine. I said, no, it's not, but a very good doctor there. And so, well, we'll have a health centre in the middle of Oxford, he said. There still is no health centre in the middle of Oxford.
No.
And there are a number of practices in the middle of Oxford. At Beaumont Street, there's three different general practices, Gordon Ganson, King Edward Street, North Oxford has got no health centre in the centre of Oxford, and there still isn't. And it's amazing. We very nearly got one in the 1970s, when one of those reorganisations of the health service was going, 74 I think it was a reorganisation of the health service, and the plan was in the plan was to build a health centre in George Street in Oxford, on the corner of George Street and Newin Hall Street, where the old grammar school is.
Yes.
And there was a sort of old second-hand cycle shop and various things. Oh, they were going to knock it down and put a health centre there. And the health service didn't have money to fund it. So it never happened.
Right. But they could have had it this time round, or not.
I really don't know. But, you know, the practice that I worked in for 40 years in some shape, it's in a house in Beaumont Street, a nice old house. But it's on four or five floors.
Without a lift?
No lift.
No,
it's ridiculous.
Yes.
Ridiculous. And it's still there.
Did the number of people in the practice, doctors in the practice, rise considerably?
Yes,
your time.
Of course. I mean, for the first 20 years, the practice was Richard Sweet and Fowler. So I was the junior of three doctors. And we had a list which was pretty stable of about 8,000 patients, 7,000 or 8,000 patients between us. Now the practice, I understand, has about 14,000 or 15,000. And I think there are now 10 partners in the practice. I'm glad to say half of them are ladies.
Good. Yes.
And of course we had some remarkable people in the practice. I mean, when I was appointed to this leadership job, the most Anne McPherson came. Her husband came and got a job in Oxford, and she came and finished her general practice training with me, and then just after that I found myself managed with this new job. And so we decided to take in Anne McPherson as a part-time partner. It was the best thing we ever did, because she was a remarkable person.
Yes, yes. Good, yeah, it's been a great interview. Anything else you want to say?
I think that's absolutely enough.
Yeah. Okay, well, many, many thanks.
I hope I've not harmed anybody's reputation.
No, I think you've been very discreet, René. Thanks.